today I kind of want to further our study by looking at another world religion. And I'm not sure if I'm going to stand or sit, so bear with me. Believe it or not, I find the hardest part of the service to be the call to worship, that prayer. I don't know. Maybe it's because you're communicating directly with God, with the awesome creator of the universe, you know, and I want to make sure I get that right. So I usually have a lot of pressure on that. This speaking doesn't bother me that much. I spoke at length some time ago about Gnosticism. You remember what Gnosticism is? It's the belief that there is a secret knowledge, that, yeah, you can get to God, but you need this special secret knowledge to get there. And I believe we talked at length about that, about different types of Gnosticism. What I want to talk to you today about is something that I believe is a modern form of Gnosticism, and it goes by a different name. It goes by Mormonism. When I was growing up, I really didn't know much about Mormons. I didn't have any contact with someone who claimed to be a Mormon until I went to college. And second year, down to Ohio State, I was walking across campus, and I was approached by two well-dressed young men who said, "Hey, we'd like to talk to you about Jesus Christ." Well, okay. Now, I'm already a Christian. I thought, well, you know, these guys have probably been walking around campus. Everyone's telling them to get lost. I'm going to be nice. I say, all right, let's talk. And so they say, well, you know, this isn't a very nice place to do it. Out in here in the Oval, it was cold, it was winter. So I invited them into my apartment to talk to them. When they came in, they introduced themselves and said they were Mormon and asked if I'd ever read the Book of Mormon. I confessed I had not. They handed me a copy, talked a little bit about it, and said, why don't you read this, and we're going to come back. So I did, read the Book of Mormon, and they came back, and I talked to them at length about it. Well, I'm going to fast forward and not tell you my opinions and some of the things yet. Let's fast forward to this last election cycle, when, at least to me, and maybe to you, it was really pushed upon us that Mormons were Christians just like us, just another denomination, right? Presbyterians, Methodists, Mormons, Catholics, we're all kind of the same thing. We all believe the same thing. We all believe in Christ, and we all have the same values, goals, and commitments. When I actually, though, began to research what Mormonism truly believes and how it actually operates, I found that I don't think that their values, goals, and commitments are the same as those professed by our Lord and Master, Jesus Christ. So what I'd like to do is give you a history of Mormonism as they tell it. And then at certain points along the way, I'm going to stop. I'm going to go back and give you the rest of the story that was left out. And at the end, we're going to talk about some of the doctrinal things they believe in. And some of this is... It might shock you because it's not something they publicly acknowledge or say, but it is in their writings, and it is, anyone who has been a Mormon will tell you that yes, we do believe these things. We also have some resources downstairs. We do have the Book of Mormon, if you do want to kind of verify the things I say, and then there's also a book down there called The Mormon Experience. This was by a woman who was in the Mormon church during the 1970s and 1980s, who then became a believer in Christ and talks about her experience with the church. So those are two of the resources I used to put together this talk. First, I'd like to talk about the history of the Mormon church as they tell it. So we go back to about 1820, and there's a young boy, about 14 years old, whose name is Joseph Smith. And during in America at this time, there was a great fervor in revival movements, but not just any revival movements. These revival movements really focused in on mysticism, on visions, on sequestering yourself kind of away and out of society, which has really kind of been history here in America. We've got a lot of different groups that try to do that, sequester themselves, get these visions, this mysticism, Ephrata Cloister in Pennsylvania, Zohar here in Ohio, the Shakers. There's just a lot of this So about this time, this was fairly popular. So anyway, he goes out, he's praying to get the truth, and he gets a vision. And in this vision, he sees God the Father and God the Son in the flesh, and God the Father points to his Son and says, listen to him, you know, what he has to tell you is important. In this vision, he is told that he's going to be visited later and that the truth is going to be revealed to him. So he, you know, he's amazed by this, goes back home, and 3 years later, he has another vision. This time he's visited by an angel called Moroni. And the angel of Moroni reveals to him that the real truth of what is going on has been written down on golden tablets or golden disks, and that these golden disks have been buried in upstate New York. And the angel shows Joseph where these golden tablets are buried. Joseph digs them up, he finds a box. Inside the box are the golden tablets, as well as some, they're called the Uman, the Urim and the Thummim, which he describes as spectacles, two glasses that help you translate the tablets. So you put them on and suddenly you can read the words that are written on these golden tablets. So he has a number of these visions with this angel Moroni over the next 5 to 6 years, where the angel shows him where subsequent tablets are buried. And he begins the process of translating these tablets. While he's being translated, the angel tells him, though, not to tell anybody that he has found these golden tablets or that anything about his vision and so forth. Well, he makes the mistake of doing so. So he tells somebody, hey, I found this. A rumor goes around that there's a golden Bible that's been found in upstate New York, and somebody breaks into his home and steals his translation that he's transcribed, and runs away with it. The first 116 pages of the Book of Mormon are gone. God comes back to him and says, well, you know, it's all right. We'll make do with what you have from here on out. Continue to translate. So with the help of several people, his wife Emma, he continues to work on translating the Book of Mormon. In about 1830, he finishes up. The book is published, and of course there's a lot of ridicule, a lot of persecution, because the Book of Mormon says here's a new vision, a new prophet has been given, and that new prophet is now Joseph Smith. So you had Jesus, and that was good, but now Joseph Smith, here we're in the latter days, he saw this vision, and now there's a new revelation. In the Book of Mormon, and has anyone here read it? Just a little bit. All right, so very briefly, synopsis of the Book of Mormon. It tries to tell the history of the Native American peoples here in the United States and South America. And the claim is that the lost tribes of Israel, when they were kicked out by the Assyrians, migrated across the ocean and landed here in the New World, where they set up civilization. And through the course of the civilization, they had great heroes, there was fighting, and it tries to explain all of the things that Americans were seeing in Native American culture at that time. So that's kind of a very brief history of what's going on, what they claim. They're claiming that the Native Americans are Jewish. That is kind of one of the big claims in Mormonism. So anyway, 1830, publishes the book. Of course, people are like, what are you talking about? And so there tends to be some persecution, but, a lot of people are looking for someone who's had visions, who's seen things, and they like that. And so they glom on and begin listening to him. He's a very charismatic young man. The pictures of him show he's very good looking, he's very striking. So of course, he has a way of speaking, a way of appealing to people, to their desires, and so they start to follow him. Over the next few years, he develops a church in upstate New York. It's persecuted. They leave upstate New York and they travel to Ohio, Kirtland, Ohio, where they develop a community there. In 1835, this church in Kirkland manages to acquire a manuscript, an Egyptian manuscript that they claim, and the Mormon church still claims today, has writings on it that Joseph Smith is able to translate and determine that this is written by Abraham. He wrote it down on this this parchment, I think it's more of a linen cloth, and they translate and they come up with another book called the Book of Abraham. And that's written down and then disseminated. All right, so now I'm going to go back. Hopefully that's enough for us to kind of get in our heads. And I'm going to tell you some of the other things they don't tell you about Joseph Smith. Well, first of all, Joseph Smith was a treasure hunter. He made money by going to people in towns and villages in New York and said, hey, you know the legend of the buried Iroquois treasure? Yeah, thousands and thousands of dollars of gold coins and artifacts. I know where it is. Well, I know roughly where it is. And if you pay me some money, I'll take you out to where this buried Iroquois treasure is, or roughly where it is, and then you can dig it up and, hey, you're going to make a fortune. And the reason I can do this is because I have this magic stone, magic seer stone. And what I do is I take this seer stone and I'll put it in my hat and I bury my face in the hat and then I get a vision of where this treasure is and I'll lead you to it. How do we know this is true? Because he was convicted of this crime in New York, and there's a legal record of it, that he was convicted of being a fraud and a charlatan, taking people out to where this treasure was supposed to be, gets his payment, he leaves, they dig up an entire field and of course find nothing. Or maybe they find a few arrowheads and he says, well, I guess it wasn't the greatest treasure, but it was there, I was right, see? I could take you to almost any farm field around here and I guarantee you, you dig long enough, you're gonna find some Indian artifacts. You'll find some arrowheads, you might find a few other things, but probably not great treasure. So this is how Joseph Smith is making his living. In addition, that first vision that I told you about that he had when he was 14, well, there's no written account, there's no record of that in any Mormon writings until after 1840. See, during the first period, when he writes the Book of Mormon, when he starts gathering his church, there's no mention of this vision. It's not until after 1840 when there's an attempt to legitimize that this is truly a Christian faith that he comes up with this vision he had at 14. The golden tablets. There was never anybody who ever witnessed these golden tablets except for Joseph Smith. There are seven different accounts of people who saw him translating. And the way he would translate is to take his magic stone, put it in his hat, bury his face in the hat, and then he said, I see a letter. I don't understand it. And then a word would pop up. He would say a word and a line, which his wife, Emma, or some friends would transcribe right down on a piece of paper. Nobody actually saw these golden tablets, and that's how the translation occurred, with his head buried in a hat. So those are your golden tablets. Your Urim and your Thummim, again, nobody ever saw these. The magic stone is the only thing anyone ever saw him use in order to translate. Where was I? All right, so he manages to gather a congregation together and publishes this Book of Mormon, which tells the history of the Native Americans. Now, I happen to go to school for archaeology, so I tend to know a little bit about ancient societies and some of the things to look for. When the two Mormon gentlemen came back and spoke to me, these were the questions that I had for them. My question one, you claim that the Jews, the lost tribes of Israel, came over to the New World, and that is the Native American population. I said, so why is there no genetic evidence of this? Should there not be genetic evidence in the Native American peoples that they descended from Jews? It would be in some of them. I said, well, you know, we don't know about that. We just know what's written in the book. Okay, maybe you don't know about that. Let me give you another one. How about the wheel? The Native American cultures in the New World did not have the technology of the wheel. They never developed it. Yet, this was something that was common throughout the ancient world, the ancient Near East, Greece, Rome, Palestine, Egypt, technology of the wheel for transportation. And it was never used here in the New World. Why not? You would think that something so basic as a transportation wheel would have been brought with them. Well, I'm sorry, we don't know about that. Okay. Well, you claim in there that the Jews brought horses with them. It says in here that they brought horses with them to the New World, and they introduced horses here. But there were no horses here when Columbus arrived, and the Spanish never saw any horses until they brought horses with them. How about that? How does that work? You know what? We don't know about that. We just know what's written in the book, and that's what's true. There is a lot of archaeological problems with the Book of Mormon as it's written, because it just doesn't match with any of the archaeological evidence. And I'll contrast that to what they find in Palestine today that bolsters what it says in the Bible. How they find a lost civilization, or they'll find a lost city, and the evidence points to how, wow, we didn't realize that, you know, hey, there is actually was a King David. Huh. We find evidence, archaeological evidence supports what's written in the Old Testament. And most scholars will not disagree with the historical value of the Old Testament or the New Testament as a book. Whereas the Book of Mormon, most scholars discount it and say it's a fabrication. It because it doesn't bear any resemblance to what we see out in the field of archaeology. All right. So about 1840, Joseph Smith joins the Masons. Joins that society. 2 weeks after he joins the Masons, he then forms an inner circle of 12 men, and he bestows on them kind of this secret knowledge that he's been given, and he has them go through a certain a ceremony to kind of purify them, to make sure they're ready to receive this knowledge. After they go through this ceremony, he then reveals to them that he has been given a vision by God that he should have more than one wife. He should be able to marry a lot of women, have them as spiritual wives. But they keep this secret, and he decides to start marrying some of these other wives, some of the other members in the church, as spiritual wives. Well, eventually this gets out, and of course that really makes the persecution go up a notch, because polygamy, and in some cases polyandry, tend to be looked on with disfavor by a predominantly Christian culture. So the persecution tends to ratchet up over these next 5 years, between 1840 and 1845. During that time, the church is kind of kicked out of Kirkland, and it moves first to Missouri and then into Illinois, into a place called Nauvoo. I believe I'm pronouncing that correctly. In 1844, the Mormon Church had started to lose quite a few people because of this doctrine of marriage plurality that Joseph Smith had introduced. And in 1844, Joseph Smith is caught and he's taken to prison for this and for a number of other reasons. And while he's in that prison, a mob comes, attacks, and he is killed during the ensuing fight. In his last words, something he calls out, "O Lord, my God," as he falls from the window and dies. Most people thought this would be the end of Mormonism, but the Council of Twelve gets together and they elect a new leader, Brigham Young, who is as charismatic as Joseph Smith, and who believes the same things. Brigham Young gets up and speaks in front of the congregation of the church and says, "The Council of Twelve has appointed me. I am a prophet." Before Joseph Smith died, he made all of the Council of Twelve prophets, so we have the same abilities and talents that he does, and I've been appointed as the leader. While he's speaking, he's transfigured before their eyes. So the people begin to follow him, and at this point they move west to Utah. Again, I'm skipping over a lot of history, but between 1845 and 1852, the church publicly announces for the first time this idea of marriage plurality or polygamy that is an accepted practice. Travel to Utah, and there's some persecution out in Utah, but essentially they're free to do as they please out there. It's a territory, not a lot of control. For a while, Brigham Young is the governor of Utah before he is removed by the President of the United States. And in 1887, after years of a kind of persecution and public outrage at the polygamy, the church finally says, we talk to God, and God says that we don't have to do this anymore, so we're no longer polygamists. Now let's go back and talk about some of the other things they don't tell you in that. So starting in 1835 to 1840, Joseph Smith becomes a Mason, or goes through the rites of becoming a Mason. He then takes everything he's learned in these Masonic rites, all the ritual and so forth, and transposes them into this new Council of 12, into his church. And he creates an inner circle, forces them to go through something very similar to the Masonic rites. And they undergo this part of the new initiation now for people to be in the Mormon church is a ceremony where they must go. You're taken into the church. You're stripped of all your clothing. Two people then take you and bathe your body completely. Then you are given what's akin to a hospital garment. It's kind of a tabard where it has a front and a back, but it's open on the sides. So you're completely naked under this. You're then brought in with all the other converts to the church up in front, where the priest, which would have been Joseph Smith at the time, will anoint your body with water, wash your body with water and with oil, and they'll wash your head, nose, ears, lips, your breasts, your loins, feet and ankles. After that, oil is taken and rubbed onto those areas of body by the priest. You are naked when this happens. That is the rite that he introduces to the church. They also must go through a rite where they're handed a sacred object, and they take an oath not to reveal anything that's in this ceremony or these sacred objects. And if they do, they make the motion that I would cut my own neck, I will rip out my own heart, I will disembowel myself. This particular ritual was practiced up until 2005, very much unchanged. In 2005, they changed the ceremony so that it did not have some of these items in it. So now you're completely covered. You still have to strip naked, you still have to be washed, but now you get a covering that completely covers you and goes down to your ankles, and instead of touching all parts of your body with water and oil, now I think it's just the forehead is touched, but this was the rite as it was originally practiced. Let's talk about polygamy. You've probably heard it said by some Mormon apologists that this was done because there had been so much persecution of the Mormons that women had lost their husbands and that they didn't have anyone to support them or take care. Well, not quite true. Most of the Mormon women that Joseph Smith married in these spiritual marriages were between the age of 14 and 20, about 33% of all his extra wives. He had 30-some. So most of them were between the ages of 14 and 20. 24% were between the ages of 20 and 24. So more than half were under the age of 24. He was 38 when he died, and when he did, he only had two wives that were older than him. All the rest were his age or younger. In addition, Joseph Smith proposed to several other women who rejected him, and this isn't mentioned. Also, many of the women that Joseph Smith married were already married. As you see, the Mormon church does not recognize marriage if it does not occur in a Mormon temple. Joseph Smith himself said, unless I have performed your marriage ceremony, unless it has been performed in this temple, it is null and void, and so you're not really married to your husband. In many cases where he went to women that were already married, some were members of the church. Some were away on mission trips when he went and married their wife. He also had conjugal relations with many of them. There were many instances where this was not just a spiritual wedding, it was a physical wedding as well. Putting all of this together, you can see that the polygamy, to me, seemed to be for the benefit of a particular man. His vision apparently came from God. And he even said, I didn't want to do this, but I saw an angel of the Lord before me threatening me with a sword, that if I didn't undertake this polygamy, I was going to be, it was going to be detrimental to me and to the church, so I must do it. There were some cases where he went to members of his congregation, went to a husband and said, "The angel of the Lord came to me and told me I'm supposed to marry your wife." Husband would be distraught, crying. 3 days and three nights, there was an account of a guy who didn't eat, didn't sleep. He was, you know, so distraught by this. And finally, at the end, he acquiesced. You know, he comes in, he's broken in spirit. He says, if it's the will of God, then who am I to stand in the way, Joseph? Here's my wife. And Joseph goes, "Oh, it was just a test. You're faithful. That's all. You passed." My question, and this is probably a topic for another sermon, and it deals with revelation. Is our God the kind of God who causes chaos and destruction and despair? Does that jive with what we read in the New Testament about what Jesus came to do? To me, it does not. I'm going to talk about some of the beliefs of Mormonism, kind of stop there at about 1890, and talk about some of the things they believe. These are things that the church today believes. First of all, tithing. Tithing is mandatory in the LDS church. You must do it. In fact, if you do not tithe, you will not get into heaven. So it is a requirement. Another requirement is you're not allowed to have any sort of coffee, no drugs, no tobacco. And in the Book of Mormon, or I'm sorry, in the there's another book where they talk about the, I guess, the canon of the church. You're not allowed to have hot drinks in your belly, so you're not allowed to drink anything that's hot. So tea or coffee, anything like that. And, of course, this is coming from God. One of the stranger beliefs is a certain belief in spirituality. Mormons believe that we existed from the beginning of time, along with God, in a spirit form. And spirits right now are up somewhere in the ether, floating around, waiting for bodies to be created here on earth so they can inhabit them. And it is very important to procreate and to have lots and lots of children, because if you don't have children, then these spirits up there with God will not have a body to inhabit. So that's one of the beliefs. Modern revelation. Anything that the prophet says, the Mormon church today still has a prophet, anything the prophet says is true, is a revelation from God. I go back to the polygamy. So you let me get this straight. God reveals to Joseph Smith in 1840 or slightly before, hey, we need to have polygamy. It's a good thing. We want to do this. And then in 1890, God comes back and quoting them, what he says, if we don't get rid of this polygamy, then all Mormon temples and churches will be lost, all men will languish in jail, and no missionaries will be sent out. So God has realized that temple work and missionary work were more important than the practice of polygamy. I tend to believe that God's truths are God's truths, and they don't change in a 40-year time span. You know, if that's truly what God said to you, then you need to stand by it, not change it in 40 years because of public opinion. So, but they currently believe in modern revelation from this prophet, and if he says it, it goes. He determines what they believe. Another one is that Jesus visited the Americas. Remember I told you about the Native Americans and their histories? Well, one of the big things is after Christ died and was resurrected, he came over here to the Americas and was revealed to the Native Americans. They believe that God, as well as Christ, both have physical resurrected bodies. That Joseph Smith said that he saw God in a physical body, God the Father. The priesthood. Only members of the priesthood are allowed to marry you. Only members of the priesthood can perform certain rites and ceremonies. And some of these things are not weird or unusual. But they did not allow blacks to be in the priesthood. And in fact, for a while, Mormons were very pro-slavery under Brigham Young. They also do not allow females to be in the priesthood. They believe in multiple heavens. And here's where we're going to start to get into a little weirdness. Multiple heavens. There are three heavens. There's a celestial heaven, which is where God resides in all of the good Mormons. There is a terrestrial heaven. And below that, there is a telestial heaven. So at the bottom, the telestial heaven, is where all the people who are given to bodily lusts will go. The middle heaven is where we Christians will end up. We're not as good as Mormons. We only get up to the middle heaven. But if you're a good Mormon, you'll get up all the way to the top, to that celestial heaven, to be with God himself. Forgiveness. There are two sins in Mormonism that you can never be forgiven for. One is blaspheming the Holy Spirit, and the other one is murder. If you murder someone, you can never get into heaven under Mormonism. And the last, and this is where it starts to get wacky, they believe in multiple worlds and multiple gods. They believe that God, the God who created this world, was once a man like you, like me, who was residing in another world. And through his works, through his own righteousness, he was able to attain godhood. Once he obtained godhood, he was given this universe to be God of. And you too, under Mormonism, will attain this same godhood. If you follow the precepts of Mormonism, you will be raised upon death to godhood status, and you will be given your own universe to be in charge of as a god, as a deity. People with you will be your family. They will go with you, and you will all be gods in this new universe. God was once a man who lived on another planet very similar to Earth. He got married, he had children, he died, went up, and was given his own world. This particular world that we're in, which is the world that God created, went off track, and he came down in a physical form, found a beautiful Jewish woman, had relations with this beautiful Jewish woman, and produced Jesus. Then God went back up into heaven and kind of let Jesus go and do his thing. Truth in the Mormon church is determined by your feelings. If you're taught something in Mormonism and then you're confronted with somebody who doesn't believe that, if it makes you feel bad, it's not true. That's what they teach. So if somebody confronts you and says, you know what, I don't think the Book of Mormon is true, well, that made me feel bad. Since it made me feel bad, I know that it's not true, because only things which make me feel good are true. The Mormon Church is one of the only churches that will baptize your dead relatives. Yes, they have a procedure to baptize people who have died, gone before, but they can save them now. So if you join the Mormon Church, those people who came before that weren't Mormons, we can save them, and they'll be able to be in the celestial heaven with you. Mormons believe that their church is the only true church. All other Christian churches are wrong. In fact, that's why they created the Church of Mormon. The only way to get into heaven is to have the approval of Joseph Smith. See, Joseph Smith stands at the gates of heaven, and he has the keys. And when you go to enter that celestial heaven, if you weren't a Mormon, if you weren't married in the Mormon church, your marriage isn't valid. If you weren't a believer, then you cannot pass through and get into heaven, because he will not approve your entry. We're running a little short of time, and I've just kind of given you some snippets and things. I highly encourage you to take a look at this book. It's kind of heartbreaking at times, some of the things that are done. Get online, research this information, find out, what I've told you, verify that it's true. Gnosticism. Gnosticism is the belief that there is secret knowledge. Without this secret knowledge, you cannot access the Father. Mormonism is Gnosticism. Your marriage isn't valid unless it's in the church. You cannot get to heaven unless you are a part of this inner circle, this go through that ritual that I spoke about. There are so many different things. The more I researched into this, the more crazy and whacked out it got. And I'm trying to be as succinct as I can and not tell you some of the more ludicrous things that were practiced and some of the things they did. But in my opinion, this is not Christianity. In Mormons, in the Mormon temple, when they go to the temple on Sunday evenings, there is a, I'll call it a play for lack of a better term, a play that is performed up on the stage that they get to witness. They have to wear these special garments, these holy garments, and they're required to wear these holy garments at all times, in the church and out of the church under their regular clothing. And there is a group that will go around when you're out of church and kind of rub you on the shoulder, see if you're wearing your holy garments, because you're supposed to wear them all the time. During this play, where they reenact some scenes from the Bible, Christ is nothing more than a messenger. He takes messages from God the Father to Peter, to James, to the other disciples. He really does not play a central role. In fact, in most Mormon churches, they don't really mention Jesus Christ and the saving faith that you have in believing him. It's about adherence to the laws and regulations. It is an attempt to make yourself righteous by following their laws and their rules in order to get to heaven. So in the play, guess who the central figure is? There is a central figure who instructs the audience when to put on their garments, instructs the audience to stand up, instructs them to sing, instructs them to sit down, tells them to look at certain areas, kind of the MC of the entire show would be a kind of a good way to put it. Well, this person is also listed as a son of God and a brother to Christ, and he goes by the name of Lucifer. So I will leave it to you. Who do you think directs the Mormon Church? Rock? No, I think you can come up and sing. No, I think people are shocked enough. I think I should stop. But you can answer.